Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I want to talk a little bit about this show just for a second. I know that it's a little rough around the edges and that there's a couple of things that can make it a difficult sell. The fact that I say that it's a dramedy about mental illness rather than mental wellness or mental health. That's all right. See, mental illness has always been kind of a stigma for me. It's always been a sort of triggering thing to say. I did start to own it later in my 20s and just kind of start figuring it out and saying, I don't want this to be a defining factor in who I am and what kind of a person I am. But the fact of the matter is, it is. Whether I like it or not. You know, it would be like saying, I don't want the fact that I'm in a wheelchair to make me different. But you know what? The fact of the matter is, it does. It doesn't mean bad at all. It doesn't mean bad. It just means different. But it is different. You can't avoid an unpleasant reality. But sometimes you've got to change the reality. And that's what I'm trying to do here. I think that there are certain things that can happen when you're having these episodes and you live through them that give you amazing, ridiculous stories about the dumb shit that you've done and the ways that you've taught yourself coping mechanisms that were unhealthy and you had to rewire some stuff. Sometimes that stuff is hilarious. Sometimes it's heartbreaking, and I want to be able to explore absolutely all of that. And I don't like the idea that I'm having a difficult time getting even hiring a PR firm to try to promote this show and get it out in the public consciousness, because they don't like the fact that the word suicide is in the title. It's an anti-suicide show. What more do they want? I don't know. I think this is really personal to me. Well, I know it's personal to me. Why should you care? Here's why you should care. Not about my struggle. I mean, my struggle is nothing. It's not even a struggle. It's like first world problems. I can't find an advertiser for my podcast. But I'm talking about the capital T truth that you live with on a regular basis. You know, the things about yourself that you have a hard time expressing to other people because of fear, because of shame, because of inadequacy, because you're worried that you don't even understand exactly what it all is. I think it's important to be able to look at yourself truthfully and say, this is who I am. This is how this is. And you know what? This is the best version of me there is today. And I'm going to see if I can shine this thing up a little brighter for tomorrow. And if not, I'll try again the next day. Sometimes that's all you got. Now, speaking of things that shine, today on the show, we have got the amazing, the wonderful Jesse Beyer. We have a conversation that was ranging through all kinds of topics. And I love that. I love it more than anything. I get to spend time talking to people about these intimate things. And it's making me smarter. It's making me better. It's making me more compassionate. And I hope it's doing the same thing for you. This has been a terrible introduction. But I'm going to forgive myself and do better next time. Let's talk to Jesse. So, great. All right. Looks like this is going to work.
Awesome.
So, right out of the gate, first thing, hi, how's it going?
It's going really well. How are you?
Pretty good. It's been a productive day.
Good.
You know, recording and started running again. Running is one of those things that I have a love-hate relationship with.
I
love doing it, or rather, I love having done it.
Yep.
Getting started
is
terrible.
I feel that on many levels.
So how are things? Where are you at right now?
I am in Portland, Oregon.
Beautiful.
Yes, it really is.
Are you from Portland originally, or did you land there?
I'm kind of from all over. So I was born in Washington and moved to Oregon when I was 3. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college in Scotland, British Columbia, and Minnesota. So
Whoa.
I've been kind of all over.
Yeah, that's definitely all over.
Yeah.
What's the culture like in Scotland?
It's awesome. It's very alcohol oriented. I will say that. Mm-hmm. But the people are so nice and there's so much history there. I mean, the building that I was living in was older than the U.S. Let that sink in for a second.
Yeah, it is funny when you visit other countries and you see the things that they consider to be old. You know, and then you go to places like Los Angeles and it's like, this building is 20 years old.
Yeah, it's like, wow, it's so old. It's like, well, not really, but okay.
So, what do you do there in Portland, Oregon?
I am a speaker and personal development coach, so I work from my laptop.
Nice. How did you get involved in something like that?
It's kind of been all over, but I knew that I wanted to do something that would allow me to have the freedom to pursue passions that weren't necessarily paid, things that I couldn't really make a career out of. And I found a lot of people were in a situation where I was, where I had these huge dreams, but I was kind of befuddled by society's expectations and what my family told me to do and things like that. And I saw a lot of people like that, and I wanted to help them go through that without having to struggle as much as I did when I was going through that. So I started speaking and then threw together some online courses and kind of, you know, weaved my way through there until where I am now.
So a way of just kind of paying back with what you've learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being in that position where you feel torn between what you want and what your family wants, or you don't even know what you want. I mean, it's a lot more stressful, a lot less happy than people think it would be. And I didn't want to leave anyone in that position when I knew that there was a way through it.
Sure. Let's take this back a little farther because I'm curious. What kind of kid were you?
What kind of kid? Oh, man, that's a broad question.
Yeah.
In terms of what? Can you narrow that down at all?
No, absolutely. In terms of there's all different personality types and the kinds of people who it's always fascinating to me to see what kind of a person you were when you were little versus the progression into the person that you are now. And was it a wide progression or a thin progression?
I hear that. Okay. So I was that kid that had huge dreams and wanted to be in charge of everything and thought that I could change the world when I was, you know, 5. And for an example, I created an entire planet, like paperwork for an entire planet. I mean, citizenship applications, school schedules, the map for the zoo on this planet. Like, that's the type of kid I was. Going through high school, I think that's where I really started to, well, I guess middle and high school, but where I started to get off track and think about more of what my family wanted and what other people wanted and what I should be. I mean, I was a smart kid. I was an athletic kid. So therefore, I should go to medical school and I should do these things. And it's like, you know, high school is really where I started to merge away from where I wanted to be and who I really was. And so college was a time for me to come back to myself and figure out what I wanted to do as opposed to what I was told I should do.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a pretty detail-oriented mind.
Yeah.
Where do you think that came from?
Probably both of my parents. I mean, my parents are both very intelligent people. My mom has a master's degree from Yale. My dad was an aerospace engineer. And their career is, my mom was originally an epidemiologist and now she's a teacher and she loves it, which is great. But both of their careers and their upbringings and their education was very detail oriented. They're both very analytical people. And I think I definitely inherited that from them.
Nice. So they were constantly pushing education as an important thing.
I'd say they pushed, yes, but I'd say that they pushed kind of a traditional path of get good grades in high school, get good grades in college, get a good job, work up from there. I think they pushed that path, per se, more than the specific education part of it.
Okay, fair enough. But that was something that you decided you didn't want to go for.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, some of my lectures in college had 1,100 people in them just crammed into this room. And I don't learn that way. I mean, I need to interact and I need to do the thing. And I don't know. I mean, I still consider myself an intelligent person. I think learning is very, very important and I love learning, but school and that traditional path wasn't for me.
So what was the first thing that you decided you were going to run off and do?
So probably my first year of college. I spent my first year of college in Edinburgh, like I said, in Scotland, and I went to vet school there. And in the UK and the US, you don't need a bachelor's degree. I'm sorry, in the UK and Australia, you do not need a bachelor's degree to go to vet school. It is a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to mess around with 4 years in the US. I wanted to go straight to get my vet school, to get my DVM. And so I was like, all right, parents, this is what we're doing. And they're like, hold up. No, this is not what we're doing. So that was definitely a battle. And ever since then, it's kind of been major changes that I've made that have brought me back to where I want to be and to who I am.
Where did you get the inspiration to do this stuff, though? Like most people have some kind of a pathwork laid out for them in some way, whether it be one that they see before them in some form of media that they're consuming or a person that they see and they go, yeah, that's it. That's the eureka moment. I'm going to chase this. What was that for you?
I don't mean this to sound arrogant, but I think it was honestly myself, because when I was in high school and when I was in college sitting in those classrooms, I was literally just banging my head against a desk all day. And I was so, so tired of it. And I knew that I had these passions. I felt that there was something inside of me that just wasn't tapped into that I should follow, but that I didn't want to because I was scared of what my family would think or something like that. And I finally was like, enough is enough. I'm not happy. I'm not living to the best that I can be, to my full potential. And it was kind of that sick of it feeling that really drove me to start making those changes and take those leaps.
What was that kind of analytical thought process about where you were and frustration? Was that hard on you emotionally?
It was, but I think I was so confident that once I started making these changes, it would be better on me emotionally that I was willing to say, okay, let's use this analytical mind and make a plan for how this is actually going to look as far as execution, but then putting aside that stress of, okay, maybe this will fail, maybe this won't work, because I was confident that at least I'd be happier on the other side. I'd be more authentic on the other side of it.
That's one of the things that I think can happen with analytical people is that they tend to be, in my experience, pretty intellectually driven and goal-oriented, and they're able to solve problems, but the emotional stuff can trip you up. Is that the case with you?
I think it is to an extent. I mean, I definitely, a lot of my brand now is around mental health advocacy because I struggled with that in high school. And I think that where it really came to a head was me feeling these things and me trying to put words to them to make them make sense and then having them not make sense because you can't put words to those sorts of feelings and emotions. and then trying to communicate that to people in my life who are also very analytical and having that not go very well. So I think that's where that conundrum, I guess, between being analytical but having feelings like a human, where that really came to a head.
So, but what was that manifested as? Like you say this started in high school. What was the, what was that like for you? Where did that begin?
The conflict between the two parts of myself or the actual, it was, I think in middle school, because I mean, every teenager goes through this phase where they're like, I don't want to talk to my parents and stuff. But I was really feeling stressed about that because there were parts of myself that I didn't want my parents to see. I didn't want them to see that I was struggling, and I didn't want them to see that I was thinking about doing a different career path, a different life path than they wanted me to, because I was so worried that that was going to make them reject me or make them take away parts of my life that they had supported before, like soccer practice. It sounds really dumb, but I could have totally seen them being like, oh, well, if you're feeling this way, then you don't get to go to soccer practice. You need to come home right now and, you know, whatever. And yeah, it's not helpful when you're in that standpoint, but I think it really started with me developing my authenticity and my quote adult mind. When you start becoming a teenager, you start making your own decisions and having thoughts for yourself. And then that worry about how my family would react if they found out that I was feeling and thinking that way.
Okay. Yeah. That's, I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people take for granted, is that, that idea that you are, whatever it is you're going through, it is yours. It's mostly isolated. It's mostly internal, and it can be difficult to process those things in front of other people. And so, especially if you're analytical, you can have this idea in your head that I'm going to solve the puzzle and it's going to fix it.
Yeah.
But it might take a little more effort than that. What was the first thing that you had discovered as far as coping mechanisms for your particular brand of trouble?
Positive coping mechanisms or just any coping mechanism?
Well, let's start at the beginning. What was your process to getting to the good ones?
Yeah, so it was August 12th, 2014. I will remember that date probably for the rest of my life. But that was the first time that I started self-harming. And to me, that made sense. And I know that sounds crazy, but
I get it.
Yeah. I mean, I figured you would, but I mean, what it did for me is it took that turmoil in my mind that I couldn't make sense of and I couldn't sort through, and it centered it into one very physical, very comprehensible sensation. And that made sense.
Yes.
And it took, I remember times I would be walking across my dorm room in college and I'd be like throwing myself at the door because I there was just so much. I didn't know what to do with it. And then again, translating that into a physical sensation was very therapeutic for me. And obviously that's not necessarily the healthiest therapeutic method, but it got me through a lot of almost panic moments, you know, like almost breaking down in the middle of something. Just be like, oh, I have to go to the bathroom for a second, and then I could compose myself and come back and deal with the situation. So yeah, it's not great. And no, it's not something that I would ever suggest anyone does, but it is something that helped me in a way. But you know, as negatively helpful things often do, that definitely turned into something that was not helpful and something I wanted to get rid of, but I'd keep coming back to it because again, it made sense. And
well, and for the most part, it does work. And so when you're getting the result that you want from a negative action, it's hard to see it as a negative because it's ultimately producing a net positive, at least temporarily or in your own mind, it's producing a positive, not necessarily the case. But one of the things that you can do in a situation like that is there is something to be learned about it. And the thing you can learn is that typically the physical self-harm stuff is about control, and it's about controlling the way in which you experience things, controlling pain, controlling yourself, your body, your reactions. Mm-hmm. There's so much that goes into that where you can feel like I'm in control of this. There are other things spiraling into chaos, but I can control this. And your brain rewards you for that. with, mm-hmm. you know, the dopamine and the job well done, you know, it rewards you for that negative. So the path forward beyond that for a lot of people is exercise, weightlifting, running, you know, things like mm-hmm. that, because it's still a physical, and it's like your brain doesn't necessarily know the difference between those things mm-hmm. as far as the chemicals it's going to give you. But what was your path forward from that?
Yeah, my path forward, unfortunately, it wasn't as clear as just translating that to exercise or anything like that. It was
never is.
yeah, I know. It was a lot of trial and error, and I'd say that was one of the times when societal pressure actually really helped, because there were key people that I wanted to let into my life and that I wanted to be close with emotionally and personally, but I was so terrified that they would see the marks on my arms and think that I was disgusting or not want anything to do with me.
Yeah.
And so having that motivation, I guess, but also being able to trust them and communicate with them, because I was able to share my story with them. And there was one person that I shared my story with while I was kind of in the middle of it. And his first response, I'll always remember it. He told me that I was so much stronger than he gave me credit for. And to someone that felt so weak for using that as the coping mechanism and for having those struggles, that was so revolutionary to me. But anyway, having key people in my life that I could give, scissors was my object of choice, that I could give my scissors to, that I could, you know, that I could say, hey, I'm struggling, take this so I don't do anything dumb, you know, and having them on my side and knowing what was going on, that was really, really helpful for me. And just over time, it stopped. And, you know, there'd be times where I'd be quote clean for 6 months and then something really bad would happen and I'd go back to it. And then it would be like, no, Jesse, you're stronger than this. You're better than this. And then I'd be like, okay, we're not going to do that again. We're going to move on. And the frequency between those fallbacks got longer and longer and longer until now it's been close to 3 years. So
nice. Well, congratulations on 3 years.
Thank you.
but through this whole process, while you're dealing with this and you're learning your coping mechanisms, mm-hmm. in your day-to-day life and the things that you need to accomplish, you're getting things done. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's not quite as easy as it would seem. Like in a afternoon movie, you know, where it's pretty obvious to the people around you that you're having a problem. But I mean, ultimately you're getting shit done.
Right. Right. So, I mean,
Yeah. You just, I mean, it's hard to, it's hard for you to be able to look at your behavior as all that damaging because it's not affecting the things that need to get done. So you start to justify it to yourself after a bit.
Yeah, I think it was that way for me, but it was also almost the opposite because I hated it. I hated that I was doing it, but it allowed me to center myself so that other people wouldn't know so that I could still get things done. So it was like, it wasn't justified in a way. It was hated despite the facts that it was almost helpful. So I don't know. It's a weird circle there.
Yeah, it is kind of a strange thing. Was a conversation about mental health something that you had ever really had up to that point?
No, not at all. I mean, my parents were great giving me the birds and the bees talk, I think 6 different times, like they were on top of that.
Yeah.
But that was, mental health was never really a conversation that came up in my home.
What about societal? What were your mental health touchstones as far as culture?
Honestly, really none. I mean, I went to a elementary and middle school where my 8th grade graduating class had 14 people in it, and it was a very religious institution. I went to a religious high school where my graduating class was 93, so like 2 small religious schools.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even talk about birth control, let alone some of these mental health. Yeah, some of these mental health things. So, I mean, sure, I saw things on TV about like, oh, well, now with this medication, I can, you know, live with depression or whatever those ads were on TV. But I mean, you're 13, you don't pay attention to that. Right. Or at least I didn't pay attention to that. So it wasn't, I knew that it happened and I knew that there were people that struggled with it. And I knew on an intellectual level what that looked like, but I never had any really emotional discussions about, okay, this is what it could mean for you. This is how you can handle it. This is us, meaning parents, telling you that we're on your side. That never happened.
You hadn't really connected it to yourself in any way.
No. Mm-mm.
So when did you first come to terms with the idea that there was something that was off, that needed correction?
Well, I think, so my high school journey gets even more complex, fantastically, by one of my really good friends was kind of two steps worse than me in the mental health mm-hmm. journey. Like, he started self-harming before I did. He became suicidal. He attempted suicide, and I was right there with him, both as being a support system and trying to help him through it, but also struggling myself.
Yeah.
And I think that recognizing different things in him and hearing things that he was struggling with, some of those clicked with me because I could see, I don't want to use the term wrong, because I don't believe that there's something wrong with people who are struggling with mental health, but
sure.
I knew that he was struggling with something that wasn't right. You know, that's not how he deserved to live. He deserved better than that.
Right.
And knowing that, and then resonating with some of the things that he was saying about how he was feeling and how he was handling it, that kind of made that connection in my mind. Like, okay, I'm putting labels to the things that are happening in my life. This is something that I need to work on too.
Yeah. Did you start seeing a therapist at any point, or was it, books, or what was the first external kind of help point?
Yeah. So the night that he attempted suicide, I ended up calling the cops on him to prevent him from killing himself. And after that, I went and saw a therapist for one day and hated her. Like, it did not go well. I was 17 and I was absolutely terrified that if I said the wrong thing, she'd tell my parents. And my parents didn't know about any of the stuff that I struggled with. And so I was terrified of that. And then we had a 45-minute session, I believe. And at the end of that, she slapped a diagnosis on me and was like, yep, we don't need to tell your parents. See you next week. I'm like, what? I didn't feel heard as an individual. I didn't feel like she heard my whole story, which is partly my fault because I didn't want to tell the whole story because of that aforementioned fear of the parents.
Yeah.
So it was a bad circle. So that was really my first interaction with therapy. But I went and saw a therapist when I was in college, and she was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I loved her. I got so much out of working with her. Yeah. So I have good experiences with therapy. Just that first one was not a great time.
Yeah. And that's a conversation that people don't really have, is that, therapists and medication alike, both of those are situations where it may not be the right fit the first time around, and mm-hmm. you might have to try something else. If someone's not clicking for you, you're absolutely within your bounds to go, I don't think this is going to work. I need yeah. somebody that I'm going to feel safe with, because if I'm ever going to open up and start trying to be vulnerable with this other person and let them know exactly what's going on. I can't afford to have boundaries in front of me that are that strict that I don't want to talk to this person.
Yeah.
You also can't like your therapist too much, because, you know, then you can get into this idea that you're friends.
Right. 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 Well, I mean, that's what I told my therapist when I was in college, is it was so great to have her not be involved in my life. And she laughed. Yeah. And I'm like, no, it's so true, because you're not my friend. You're not my family member. You have no personal investment in my life. So you can be an unbiased opinion and
yes.
show me some mindset things where it's like, okay, well, this is what you believe, but this isn't necessarily the case. I mean, my boyfriend in college was fantastic at always picking my side and like picking up my flag and running with it when something went wrong.
Yeah.
And I loved him for that. And that's what he should do as my boyfriend. But if my right. therapist did that, it's like, no, I need you to be unbiased. I need you to be not on my side, but on the side of health, and help me through that.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming out the other side of all of that, mm-hmm. when did you first start discovering that you had, some tools that might be of use to other people?
Kind of throughout the whole process because of that relationship with my friend in high school, because I felt so strongly that I was capable of deep love and of support and non-judgment and unconditional anything. And that kind of transformed from a personal ability to do that to a belief that I can do that professionally as well. And so it was starting in that relationship. And then as I got through it, and then in college, seeing that other people were struggling too, and realizing that, wow, this is a real conversation and I have a story that can maybe help someone else. It was kind of all of that combined that was like, you know, I should really do something with this to stop hating what happened back then and actually use it for something good in the future.
Yeah. And that's incredibly inspiring to hear. You know, when someone goes through something and they come out the other side and decide that they're going to, you know, be public about it. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but I mean, not necessarily even all of the mental health struggles and everything, but, you know, just the very idea of the things that you can learn about yourself in your day-to-day life from a struggle with a mental health problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you can take those things and apply them to so many other areas. It teaches you about perseverance and strength.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's been so many times where I'm facing a challenge in my life now, whether that's personal or professional, and it's like, okay, you made it through all that before. I think you can handle this right now. You know, and it is. You have that strength of, I've been through so much worse and I can do this now.
Yeah. Well, and tell me a little bit about, you know, what it is you're doing now.
Yeah. So like I said, I'm a speaker and personal development coach. So I speak, obviously, and then I do a lot of online courses and coaching and things like that as well. And one of my speaking topics actually starts with my story of mental health struggles and how I overcame that, and then give some actionable tips for people looking to find motivation in their own life. So it does go back to that personal development, but I just want to share both the lessons that I've learned and my personal story with people, because I know how powerful personal stories can be. I mean, you hear stories of other people who have done incredible things, whether that's mental health related or not, you know, overcoming mental health struggles or something completely different. And having just one more story out there, maybe that'll resonate with just one more person that can help them. So that's really what I'm trying to do, is just get my message out there to as many people as I can, because I know how impactful the things that I teach were for me. And I'm just hoping that I can be that person for someone else.
Absolutely. That's one of the most important things that we can do for each other is, when someone is feeling small, to be able to stand up and say, I'm here for you. I can help. Mm-hmm. I have something. Here's a toolbox full of things. I don't know if you need a screwdriver or a wrench, but I'm gonna show you everything that I got here, and some of this is probably gonna help you.
Mm-hmm. And even almost more importantly than that is just, mental health struggles can be so shrouded in shame, and having someone say, "Hey, I've been there. I'm not gonna judge you," and just sit with you through that's almost even more powerful than saying, here are some things you can do or tools that you can use.
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes all it takes is just listening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't even have to try to assist. Just listen to someone talk about what they're struggling with and just believe them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Validating someone else's emotions when they're struggling, whether that's with depression or self-harm or trauma or whatever that is, validating their emotions and saying, you have a right to feel however you want to feel and however you need to feel right now.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you laugh, but it's so true, because there's so many times where it's like, oh, it wasn't that bad, or oh, she had it worse, or oh, this, or oh, that try to minimize people's emotions. And it's like, that is so unhelpful.
Yeah.
I don't know why you think that's helpful. But yeah, just having someone say, you're allowed to feel what ever you need to feel, it can be so powerful too.
Yeah. You can't really qualify someone's pain. It's a difficult thing to put a value on, because the worst mm-hmm. pain that there is yours. That's
yeah.
just period. That's just how it is. And you can't buy your way out of it. You can't run your way out of it. you know, it's, it, you can't eat your way out of it. You can't really yeah. do anything with it other than accept it and observe it and let it move through you and hope you can learn something from it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's so many, you even see it in other areas of life, you know, posts on Facebook where it's like, how dare you complain about your undercooked dinner when there's starving children in Africa. And it's like, right. yes, starving children in Africa are awful, but you have no idea what my day was just like. And maybe the only thing that was keeping me going was that well-cooked steak at dinner. And now it's not there. And that's why I'm crying over steak. You know, like yeah. you don't know that story behind why it's hurting them as much as it is. So you have no right to judge on yeah. how they're feeling or how much they're feeling.
Right. And it doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't do you any good. It doesn't do them any good. And chances are, if you're feeling a high level of judgment, it's saying a little bit about you and where you are in your current struggle with what you're dealing with. And sometimes it helps to evaluate yourself before you say something. The internet is such a strange place because it can be used for such good, but it can be used so ridiculously as well.
It always bugs me because on my Facebook page, I post a lot of quotes and questions to get you thinking about your life and yourself and things like that. And there's always this one person that just needs to come in and like crap all over that with some negative comment on an inspirational quote. Like yeah. some guy the other day, I posted a quote that was from Buddha, and he goes on this rant on my post about how Buddha never wrote anything down, so we don't actually know what he said. So stop trying to preach him and live like him instead. And it's like, okay, well, by your logic, you don't know how he's supposed to, like, there's no way to be negative on someone else's post. And it's like, why?
Yeah. What is the value of tearing this down for either one of us?
I know. Yeah.
That's an interesting thought process as well. The idea of assessing the value of something, you know, assessing the value of your thoughts, the value of your words, it's pretty important to recognize the types of things that you place value on and the type of language you use to express yourself about those things. What do you know about using positive language as an expressive tool for thinking better?
I think it is so, so critical, because if you're sitting there in your mind thinking, I'm worthless, I'm useless, I can't do anything, or whatever other negative thought you're running through your head, that's what you're going to make more of. Now, I don't necessarily believe in manifestation in the terms of
right.
you think of a Lamborghini enough and a Lamborghini appears. No,
right.
but the way that you direct your mind and the way that you speak about yourself and to yourself is so powerful, because that's what you believe.
Yeah.
And if you believe you are useless, you will act like you are useless, and then it's just a downward spiral, you know? So I think speaking to yourself and not using obviously negative adjectives like useless or whatever, but not saying can't, not saying should, not saying have to, not saying those things that are going to place you in a rut that you don't belong in, that you're bigger than, I think that's really important as well.
Well, what role does ownership over everything that's happening to you take in all of this as far as self-development goes?
I think it's important that you recognize it, but I don't think it's helpful if you say it's all my fault or none of it's my fault. Like, there are aspects of your life that you control and that, yeah, maybe aren't helpful and you can change, but there's also things that happen to you that you have no control of. So right. learning to differentiate between those and letting the ones that you can't control go, but recognizing your responsibility and the things that you can change, I think that's really, really critical.
Yeah. I think the only thing that you can control sometimes is your reaction to things. But there are going to be plenty of things that happen to you that you have absolutely no control over. Just think about the weather. The weather is something you have no control over, but you do have control over how you react to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually wrote an email to my email list the other day about the crappiest week I had, because it was just like every single grumpy person crawled out of their hole to come make my life miserable. For example, I have a dog. She's adorable. But we were in town by a stoplight, and there's a little patch of grass, and she was pooing on the patch of grass. And this woman who stopped at the stoplight leans rolls down her window, leans across her seat, sticks her head out of the car, and makes this passive-aggressive comment about me cleaning up my poo while she's actively going, like, I can't do anything right now. And it was just thing after thing after thing after thing, and it was like, my God, why? Why does everyone need to be grumpy this week? And it actually took a really good heart-to-heart conversation with my mom to understand that, you know, if it's not going to matter, then don't worry about it. Their opinions of you make absolutely no difference in how good of a person you are, how successful you can be. So having that mindset of, yeah, they can be grumpy all they want, but that has no impact on my life has been super critical. And as you can tell, I'm still learning that, like, today. It's not just something you learn once and then you're good.
No, I mean, all of this is a process. I mean, there's not really an ending to all of this. There's only better. Better is all there is. There's not a superior finished 100% version of you where you are just evolved into a ball of light. You know, it's, maybe the ball of light is where it all ultimately ends, and that's why we die. Who knows? But but for now, while you're stuck in this body and you're stuck in this world with this circumstance, what are you going to do about it? And how are you going to treat yourself in the process? And what kind of language are you going to use to talk to yourself? These are all important things that that deserve attention.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think they deserve attention for everyone, not just someone that's struggling with mental health.
Completely.
But I think the biggest lesson that I've learned being that analytical person and being a perfectionist is that you just have to give yourself grace. I mean, there's always room to grow, and that can be really disheartening because you're like, oh, I'm never going to make it, whatever make it means.
Yeah.
But, you know, being able to say, okay, I messed up, or you know what? I just can't do it today. I just need to lay in bed and watch TV. Just give yourself that grace. And that's going to make your ability to function the next day so much better, but also your relationship with yourself so much better.
Yeah, that's definitely very important. Allowing yourself the opportunity to learn from a failure or from a rough situation.
Mm-hmm. And
what about the idea of the idea of being able to allow yourself to get some things wrong? I mean, that's got to be, and also by that, I guess I mean this idea that we always feel like we should be moving forward. We should be using positive language and things like that. But I think that it can be valuable sometimes to go ahead and just vent stuff out.
Yeah.
Is that what do you think about that?
I think I've a couple part answer, but the first part is that sometimes when you're trying to change a habit, especially in terms of the language that you're using, the first step is to just recognize when you mess up and not even try to change it. For example, I am constantly working on improving my eloquence and communication, and that I don't want to say like and all the time.
Right.
And when I started working on that, I'd catch myself saying it all the time. I'd be like, Jesse, why can't you just fix it? But it's that first step of just recognizing it, just catching it, and then slowly you learn to fix it, and then slowly it becomes something you don't say anymore. So that's part one. I think that's important as far as how you start making those language changes. But in terms of being able to learn from your mistakes and grow for them and give yourself grace, again, it's a process. It's never going to be something that you get perfectly down, but just starting somewhere, starting with one day, starting with this one time I'm going to make this good choice for myself. And then that just becomes easier and easier over time.
How comfortable are you with yourself now?
I think I'm quite comfortable with myself, and it's great. Honestly, like, you want to ask me any question about anything, I'm going to be happy to talk to you about it. I'm an open book if you want to ask. And I think that's a great way to live. You know, I mean, when you're building relationships, you need to be vulnerable to get to those deep relationship stages. And I'm just going to jump there. Like, I'm not going to dance around the surface. I'm just going to jump right in. And if you want to join me, that's great. If you don't, that's great too. But I want to be completely myself and as open as I can with other people. Again, in hopes that maybe I can help someone, but also just because I feel like that's the best and most fun way to live.
What do you think came first? Do you think that the openness made you better, or do you think that being better made you more open?
I think being better definitely made me more open. And I think also seeing other people struggling made me more open too, because it was like, oh, I'm not alone. There's people that understand this. There's people I can talk to about this. And then once I started talking with people that understood, I was more willing to talk with people who wouldn't understand and kind of go from there.
Yeah. It is pretty important to be able to talk to people openly and honestly if you're capable of it. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is capable of that, and that's not everybody's path. But for the people that are capable of it, I think that I don't know if there's so much an obligation. I don't know if I want to go that far as saying that there's some kind of a moral obligation. But there is certainly an appreciation from people when they see, oh, this person is talking about this in a way that I really needed to hear today. And for whether it be 400 people or four people or one person, if you're able to help someone by saying, I went through this and I lived through it, and I don't know, this is hopefully going to help you figure out that you can live through it too. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is. I think that's incredibly powerful.
It is. I mean, we had a bunch of motivational speakers that came in high school to various conferences and events that I went to, and all of them had their own story of struggle, mm-hmm. whatever that was. And I remember sitting there thinking, they're not ashamed of that.
Yeah.
They're willing to talk about it. This isn't something that they're trying to shove under the rug. And I think that was almost more important and more impactful to me than what their story was or how they overcame it. But just the fact that I don't have to be ashamed of this. You know, I can use this for good. I don't have to be scared of this or hide this. I think that was really empowering too.
Are the people that are in your life now, are they all pretty accepting of the fact that you talk about things publicly?
I think some of them are and some of them don't know. So, yeah, I think my boyfriend in college was fantastic. He was so supportive, like I said, and he was like, talk about it if you want, don't talk about it if you want, whatever you want to do, I'm gonna have your back. And that was cool.
Yeah.
But the family relationships are still something that I'm building and working on. But what I've learned with that is that not every relationship has to be this incredibly deep one. It can be however you want it to be. If they aren't willing to go there or aren't able to go there, then they don't. And then you have great Saturdays at the zoo and you call it good. You know, whatever that looks like to you, it doesn't have to be this deep emotional relationship with every single person that's in your life.
That is a very profound statement that I don't think people talk about enough. That idea that the people that are in your life, having an expectation on what that relationship is supposed to be versus having an understanding of what that relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people talk about that very much at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely something that I kind of had to figure out as I went along, because there were relationships that I was just banging my head against the wall trying to figure out, do I want them in my life or do I not want them in my life, without recognizing that there was a middle ground where they could be in my life but not have access to every single part of me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's actually maybe one of the favorite things I've heard in the past few days.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important. I'm really glad that you brought that up. I have struggled with that myself, especially with family relationships. Family is something that's always been kind of complicated for me. I always felt like I was quite different from the rest of my family. And I definitely had those value judgments of, well, family is supposed to be this. I'm supposed to be close with my siblings. I'm supposed to want to go to family gatherings. And, you know, the way that I was raised thinking about family was, family's family and that's that. And if you wouldn't accept it from another person, family's different. But my thought was, you know, if grandpa's a racist, I kind of don't want to hang out with grandpa.
Yep.
And so that was, I mean, it's kind of funny now, but at the time that was a big struggle and that was a strange conversation to have. But then ultimately being able to recognize that there are certain people that I'm able to have in my life in the role that they play, in the place that they fit. That's a tough lesson to learn. How long did it take you to put that together? Or are you still piecing it together?
Oh, I'm still totally piecing it together. I think it's been kind of step by step, depending on the relationship. Some relationships seem easier to kind of take to the outer circle, but some, like you said, family relationships for me, I definitely believe that it was, oh, well, it's your dad. It doesn't matter. Or it's your mom. She's going to love you no matter what. You have to love her no matter what too. And I do love her and I have a great relationship with her, but it doesn't have to be that way. So I think it kind of depends on the relationship, how quickly I figured it out, but I've definitely come to the point where I recognize my value. I recognize my worth and I recognize what I deserve to be treated like. And if you don't want to accept me for me, then we can have those Saturdays at the zoo and you can be on that outer circle, but still be in my life, just not in the same way.
Well, I mean, that's incredibly powerful. And really, really, honestly, that I think that that's going to resonate with a lot of people is recognizing that you don't need permission to start assigning people to the areas of your life where they fit and not try to jam a square peg into a round hole.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a lot easier for people to recognize that, oh, my soccer teammate isn't the first person I'm going to go to when something goes horribly wrong. But I think it's harder for people to recognize that someone can be in a role that you thought had to be very close and you can move them outwards. You know, I think that that transition, as opposed to getting closer with someone, is a lot harder for people to understand.
So let me ask you this. When you learn something new about yourself, do you tend to think of that as something exciting to explore, or do you have a difficulty with accepting new information right away?
I don't really have a difficulty with accepting it, but it's not as much of a celebration as it's more of a, oh, here's another puzzle piece that fits in and it helps other things make sense.
Okay. Yeah, that's because I find that there's a lot of different ways you can approach that depending on your personality. I always find that really interesting because I'm pretty change averse and it's not something I like. And I'm aware of that about myself. You know, being aware of that and being okay with that are two different things.
Absolutely.
I've got to be more vigilant about things like that. Even positive change. Positive change even throws me off a little bit. So knowing that about myself, I feel like I've got a responsibility to react accordingly. So when something comes up, I typically try not to trust my first instinct. I want to take a moment and think about it. Is this really scary? Is this really bad? Or are you overreacting just because it's change? And usually I'm overreacting because it's
change. Well, the thing with that too is, again, with that middle ground of recognizing your language without trying to change it, just because you learn something new about yourself doesn't mean that you have to implement that knowledge immediately. You can sit with it and let it marinate and understand it a little bit and then do something with it or not. But, you know, it doesn't have to be this revelation that changes your life right away.
So not every bit of information requires action.
Right. At least not immediately.
Of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, all of this has been profoundly insightful for me, and I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this. And I just want to say thanks for talking to me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's nice to be able to have someone that resonates with being completely open and talking about some of the things that society doesn't always want to talk about.
Absolutely. You know what? The introduction might have gone off the rails, but the conversation stayed firmly on them. And I can feel good about that, right? That was a really wonderful talk. And if you want more Jesse in your life, and I know you do, you can go to jessebuyerinternational.com. You want some Instagram? You got it. Jesse Buyer International on Instagram and also on Facebook. You can also find me on the Facebooks and on the Instagram as Coffee Over Suicide. And don't forget, if you need some guests for your podcast, why not go to podcastguests.com? They've been the one supporter that I have had this whole time, and I cannot thank them enough for going along on this ride with me and being so supportive and so helpful. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.